Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. It's a beautiful day in Florida and we are live here in the studio and I am hoping to be able to go to Ramallah and talk to a fascinating American human being who have founded a fascinating organization that has a chapter here locally in Tampa. Stay tuned and listen to this song by Omar Bashir. Welcome back to True Talk. I hope you enjoy this music. It's the oud instrument, and this is Omar from Iraq. Let me see if Steve is online. Steve?
Yes. Hi, Summer. How are you?
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk to you, Steve. I think maybe a few years ago was the last time we spoke to you. I think... Steve, we're going to be spending the whole hour if you have time, because I think what you do is amazing. You are an American who started as a journalist and went to the occupied West Bank, and then something amazing happened to you. So can you start with that, maybe 25 years ago?
Yeah, actually, it's more than 25 years ago. And I actually started as a college activist on the issue of Palestine. So when I was, I grew up in a small town in Northeast Ohio called Kent. And Kent, Ohio has a legacy a history, in fact, of in 1970, National Guard's troops came into the university here in my small town and killed four unarmed students who were protesting the Vietnam War. And growing up in that small town, it gave a certain sense of awareness and enlightenment to students like myself who, you know, have an awareness and an interest in international politics. So I grew up in a small town in Ohio, you would think not really connected to the Middle East or to any issues related to the Middle East. But this small town happened to have a legacy of this issue in which soldiers, it's the first time ever that American troops entered a university and killed students in the United States. So when the first Palestinian uprising began in late 1987 and 1988, I was a very young student of international relations at Kent State. I was actually a junior and had already read a lot about the Middle East and was aware that the Palestinian issue itself was really the root cause of the conflict between Israel and the Arab countries, particularly the Palestinians. And the source of that conflict was the uprooting of the indigenous Palestinian population in 1948, people who were forced into refugee status, either in the West Bank and Gaza, which were not conquered by Israeli forces or Zionist forces at that time. Israel wasn't created yet in the early stages, or into the refugee camps in Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. So the conflict itself had a root cause, and it was the displacement and the continued occupation and lack of political, national, and human rights for the Palestinian people. So I realized that as a college student. When the first intifadas happened, the scenes of young Palestinians being killed and shot by armed soldiers was the same images that I grew up with in my small town in Ohio. So it resonated with me more than it would with probably other kids at other universities at that time who didn't have that kind of connection or that awareness that I grew up with in Kent,
so you ended Ohio. So you ended up going to Ramallah, was it?
Yeah. So I became active on the issue of Palestinian rights during the first Intifada, when the thousands of Palestinians were in prison without trial or being killed and injured, unarmed Palestinians demonstrating for their rights, for freedom, for the same basic rights that we were born with in this country, Palestinians were struggling for and being killed for on a daily basis in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So I was active at my university and started to try to educate American students about what was happening there, just from what I understood as a student of political science, and was chosen by the ADC, the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, the ADC. They're not anti-American. They are American, very pro-American, let me add, and a great organization out of Washington. So they were putting together delegations at that time during the first year of the first Intifada, called Eyewitness Israel. And they were sending over groups of Americans to go see firsthand, because the media at that time and also today are not giving a very clear or accurate representation of what actually is happening on the ground in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So they would put together groups, tours of Americans to go and see firsthand. It was called Eyewitness Israel. And I was chosen on a student delegation of student activists to go over in December of 1988. So I spent 3 weeks in winter break between my fall and spring semester touring in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, staying with Palestinian families, seeing firsthand the conditions of the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza living under military occupation, making lots of friends, meeting Israelis, peace activists, human rights workers, doctors, seeing settlements, visiting refugee camps, the whole entire experience. And it changed my life considerably. It just had a huge, huge intellectual and emotional impact on me. And for a couple of reasons, the first and foremost is really how terrible and brutal life for Palestinians was then in December of 1988, but also today is under military occupation, under Israeli military occupation. The suffering, the hardship, the lack of basic rights to travel freely in their country, to access their land, to get medical treatment, to be educated, to work, all of the basic things we kind of take for granted in this country, they have to struggle for every single day.
Yes, let me just remind our listeners that we are talking to Steve Sosaby, and he is the founder of what is known as PCRF, Palestine Children's Relief Fund. It's an organization that Steve and his late wife founded about 25 years ago. Steve, if you hang on a second, I'm going to play an old tape. I think that will maybe we will use it to see how this whole thing started. So please listen for a few seconds.
Mm-hmm. Life.
13-year-old Mansour Abu Snida was your typical young boy living on the West Bank of Palestine until November of last year, when an Israeli soldier, for some reason, threw a grenade at a porch where he and his family were eating. Mansour lost both his legs and his hand. His 14-year-old sister Sabah suffered severe burns. Both of them were hospitalized when Steve Sosby of Kent, a freelance writer, met them in an East Jerusalem hospital.
Once I met Mansour, met the type of individual that he is, and became friends with him, I felt it was my duty to try to help him as his friend.
Help he did. Sosby embarked on a campaign to bring Mansour and Sabah back home after getting doctors across the area to donate their time.
To try to help give...
So, Steve, you went there and you started meeting all these people. How did you end up with this story on American TV?
Yeah, so after my three-week tour as a student, I finished university a year later. I still was active on speaking out about the Palestinian issue. After visiting, of course, and seeing how the life was for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, I went back when I finished university to work as a journalist and wanted to share the stories, everyday stories of the Palestinians with Americans who were not aware of what was happening on the ground there. And in the course of that work as a journalist, I met this boy who was injured in the West Bank. He's from the town called Hebron, the largest town in the southern West Bank. And I had heard about this child who was eating lunch with his family when Israeli soldier threw an anti-tank grenade near them, exploded. He lost his legs and a hand and an eye, and was only, at that time, I think 11 or 12 years old. I went and visited him in Maqasid Hospital on the Mount of Olives in East Jerusalem and befriended him. I found actually a really beautiful child, full of spirit, full of happiness, despite these terrible injuries. You know, he was in a wheelchair. And, you know, despite me being, I was just 23 years old, I didn't speak Arabic. He was just a very young Palestinian boy who didn't speak English. We had a human connection. And I felt, you know, I did a story about him. But more importantly, I wanted to do something that helped him. I felt, okay, I met this boy. It's not enough to just write a story about him. You have to do something to help him. So at that time, I was, I would go back to the States in the summertime and work in Ohio as a landscaper, freelance journalism at that time, and I'm sure it's the case today, when you're 23 years old is a very difficult way to make a living if you don't have an abundance of savings in your bank account, which I didn't. I come from a working class family. So I went back and worked and returned after I met Mansour, this boy, and went back home to work and save money to go back to Palestine again and to continue my dream of being a journalist or sharing the Palestinian story. I showed a photograph of this boy to a Lebanese American doctor in Akron, Ohio, and asked him to help if he could help me, you know, do something for him. And this doctor was a great man and actually arranged everything for Mansour and his sister, who was also injured, within a very short period of time. And I was able in May of 1990 to go and bring this boy and his sister back to Northeast Ohio. And they were the first injured Palestinian kids to come to the United States for medical care. And during the next several months, this boy got new legs, learned to walk again. Mm. His sister had surgery. She learned to walk again. And it was on the front page of the newspapers here, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the Akron Beacon Journal. It was on the local television news, one of the stories you just played that we heard. That was a TV story. And people were seeing for the first time a different side of the Palestinians. They were seeing it from a human perspective. They were seeing kids who were injured and kids who were smiling, and Palestinians as human beings. Because previously in the media, from my experience, Palestinians were very dehumanized. They were always objects and subjects, terrorists or extremists, and never seen as the way I saw them when I visited Palestine. As just everyday human beings like anywhere else in the world, trying to raise their families, educate their children, make a living, and living under extremely, extremely difficult political circumstances of military occupation. So this was what I wanted to do as a journalist. I wanted to share these stories and kind of humanize the Palestinians from the way that I saw them. And bringing these kids here, first and foremost, got these kids the care they needed. That was the most important thing. They couldn't get that treatment in the West Bank at that time. And then secondly, of course, it was able to expose the reality of what was happening on the ground in Palestine. It's something Americans should be aware of. I mean, it's our tax money that pays for this. It was helping to enlighten people on how what life is like in the West Bank and Gaza. And also, when I brought the kids, it really galvanized and organized the local community in Northeast Ohio to help out. These kids were here without their parents. You know, they needed host families. They needed volunteers. We needed people to kind of take care of them. And the community responded. We had so many people willing to help. And actually, we raised enough money to send Mansoor and his sister to college. So it really was a great achievement and a great experience. Then, of course, for me personally, I was always searching for ways to, you know, something to do in my life that had meaning and purpose. So these were really the four pillars that were accomplished by bringing the brother and sister here. And when I took them back home to Palestine after their treatment, people heard about them. Palestine's a small country. They heard about these two kids who went to America for treatment and came back, you know, much better life, much better situation. They left in wheelchairs, came back walking. And people heard about that and they came to me with other children who needed help. And so I started, you know, I put a little burned girl from Jerusalem in a hospital in Houston. I had another boy who was injured in Gaza from a bomb who lost three limbs as well. And we put him with the Shriners Hospital in Los Angeles. So I realized then I can do something for the Palestinian people by helping their kids, by healing their children. It shows a sense of solidarity and support. More importantly, it helps these kids get medical care they couldn't get. And it also was a way I could do something with my life. It also, as I said before, it kind of exposed people to what was happening on the ground there. And it also organized the Palestinian and solidarity community abroad who were looking for ways to support the Palestinian people. And we're very proud of the resistance, the uprising, the nonviolent uprising for the most part in the West Bank and Gaza. And wanted to do something to help the people there. So this was my contribution, and I started placing kids. Go ahead, I think you wanted to ask.
Yeah, I just want to remind our listeners who all who watch the news and listen to this show, and like if you were listening, Steve, to the segment I just played, the announcer or the reporter said, the Israeli army threw a bomb for some reason, like not because, for instance, this is the military and this is an occupied country. So even, you know, trying to just talk about this event of bringing this kid and his sister without having to get into the real politics that this is an occupation and there are kids who get injured. So I just want to remind our listeners that there are so many stories behind the news stories. So Steve Sosaby, lives, I think, most of his time in Ramallah. He's an American and founded an organization called PCRF. You can Google it. And it's Palestine Children's Relief Fund. And I think Steve and the PCRF are celebrating 25 years since establishing this humanitarian organization. So, Steve, we're celebrating, or you are celebrating 25 years. I want to move forward because I want to bring on in 5 minutes Faris Abu Faris, who is almost 50 years old. But on August 21st, 1988, he will tell us a little bit about his story. So let's move forward. How many people have this foundation helped so far?
Well, tens of thousands, and most of them children. And we've brought over 2,000 kids since the first children who came, as I told you, Mansoor and Sabah, his sister. Since those two came, we've brought over 2,000 children to the United States and other countries, but 90% of them to the United States for free care. And Faris, Abu Faris, is one of those children that we helped. He's not a child anymore, but at that time was early on when we first started the organization. In addition, we sponsor medical missions to go overseas to treat children in local hospitals. And we treat thousands and thousands of kids a year by sending hundreds of volunteer surgeons from all over the world. We have from every country in Europe, North and South America, from Asia, the Middle East. They go through our organization to local hospitals and provide specialized surgical care, whether it's open heart surgery, orthopedic, spine surgery, neurosurgery, all of these subspecialties which don't exist in the Palestinian health sector are underserved. We provide those services for free by bringing in the volunteers.
Steve, in this community in Tampa and in Florida, we have so many physicians in all specialties. Can you explain exactly how do you do these missions? Do you approach doctors in areas, or can you explain the logistics of it? So maybe if we have physicians listening and would like to participate, they might get the chance to do so.
Sure. Well, of course, we do both. We kind of look for doctors in specialties where we know we're specialists and maybe reach out to them by email or in other ways. Or people come to us. I would say the vast majority of doctors who work with us, who volunteer with us, reach out to us and say, hey, I saw the work you do. I'd like to join. And actually, before COVID, we did 175 volunteer medical missions, not teams only, but missions to the Middle East in 2019. And of those 175 teams that went over missions, 90% of those were doctors who were on repeat missions. So they go every 6 weeks or every 6 months or once a year. They take their own vacation time and volunteer through our organization, which means they trust us. It means they know that we run a professional service on the ground, that we're able to take care of all of the logistics. So anybody who's interested out there listening who would like to volunteer, it doesn't have to be just a physician. You can be, we have a Tampa chapter for our organization. So if you'd like to volunteer and be a part of our chapter in the Tampa Bay area, please just visit our website, which is pcrf.net. And
Lena Kiswani, who is president of the Tampa chapter, is going to join us in 15 minutes or so. So we can she can talk more about that, Steve.
So I just want to clarify things. Yeah. So if you don't mind, it's actually our 30-year anniversary. Okay. We started in 1991. No problem. It's okay. After a while, it just all kind of molds together. And just to clarify how we help kids, in addition to those areas that I mentioned, which we bring children out for medical care and we send volunteer doctors in to operate locally, we've also built two cancer departments for children on the ground, one in Gaza, one in Bethlehem, which are open and functioning and have patients every day being treated for cancer. So we are treating hundreds of kids with cancer every year in the occupied territories for free. We also do a variety of different types of sponsorship and medical care. We are treating Syrian refugees in Lebanon and Jordan by arranging their surgery in local hospitals. We are providing other types of humanitarian aid with like wheelchairs, like eyeglasses, like hearing aids, whatever a child needs, any child who needs something from a humanitarian medical perspective, our organization provides it for free. So that's an indication that we treated tens of thousands of children, and we treat thousands every year in different ways, not only by surgery, but other forms of humanitarian aid that they otherwise can't get because of their circumstances, whether it's economic or political on the ground. We're not a political organization. We're not a religious organization. Our main focus is helping children get medical care.
So, Steve, can you tell me how is the situation with COVID in the occupied territories? Is your organization able to help them in any shape or form?
Yes, definitely. With COVID on the ground in Palestine, it's a huge, huge challenge, as you can imagine, for a couple of reasons. First and foremost is that the Palestinians themselves don't have a vaccine coming anytime soon. They don't have the resources for it. The supply chain on a global scale is you know, puts countries like Palestine far on the low of the priority list, and they're competing against countries like the United States and the European countries who have better resources to obtain the vaccination. So Palestine doesn't have vaccinations coming in right now. In addition to that, you have a very underdeveloped and resource-starved Ministry of Health and hospitals that don't have the infrastructure, especially in the emergency services and intensive care services, to provide the type of care that a large number of infected people need. And in addition to that, you have people who live in very congested areas. So in the Gaza Strip, you have one of the most densely compacted populations in the world living in 8 refugee camps. Faris can speak about that because he's from a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, where if the virus takes hold, it's virtually impossible to control. And that's what we've seen on the ground in Palestine. So they have right now, I think, their third major wave of the coronavirus, and it's just overwhelming the hospitals and the communities. The only bright side, I would say, is that the Palestinian population in general is a very young population, and this virus, as we all know, is most dangerous to an older population. So the fact that Palestinians themselves are, you know, the average age is in the early 20s, you have not quite the same severity of symptoms that you have in older populations like in Europe. But nonetheless, it's still a huge burden and a huge challenge, and it's draining the Palestinian health services of providing any other type of care because of the overwhelming number of people infected with COVID.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, and we are talking to Steve Sosaby. He is an American and founder of the organization PCRF. We see so many injured Palestinians during this conflict. So what happens to them? However, Steve also helps, I think, people from Yemen, the refugee camps in Lebanon and Syria and other places. Isn't that correct, Steve?
That's true. And you did ask what we were doing on the ground there with COVID. We help any child. We don't care what their nationality or what their religion is. So Iraqi kids, Syrian kids, Yemeni kids, Lebanese, Jordanian, Palestinian, any child that comes to our attention from the Middle East, because that's where we're based, we do our best to help on a humanitarian level.
And I am pleased to say, sorry to interrupt you, but Firas is okay on the phone. Firas?
Yeah.
Faris?
Yeah, Faris, man.
Faris, good morning. Can you hear us?
Yeah, good morning. I can hear you.
Okay, Faris, we have Steve Sosaby on the phone with us, and you have a special relationship with him. Can you tell us how you met him?
Hey, good morning, Steve. How are you, man?
Hi, Faris. Hi, brother. How are you?
Good. Yeah, Steve Sosaby, to be honest with you, he's one of a kind. As Palestinian kids at that time, Steve is like a hero. I met him in 1992, you know, and he saw my face. I had that shot in my face. And I have no treatment to my country, Palestine. I'm from Gaza, but and Steve, he saw my face and he came to my house. He promised me to help me. And he did. You know, he brought me to USA.
How old were you, Faris, when you got shot? 17?
When I got shot, it was in August 23rd, 1988. I was exactly about 17 and a half.
And then after the hospital, I think you were in a coma, and then you went to jail after that?
Yeah, what happened is, like, when I got shot, you know, they took me to a ship, a hospital, you know, and so they took me to a ship, a hospital. So
I'm sorry, Firas, but your phone is not, your audio is not clear. Can you, like, go somewhere else, move a little bit?
Hello?
Yeah, I can hardly hear you, Firas.
You can hardly hear me?
Yeah, now is better. Now, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm saying, and when I got shot at that day, they took me to the hospital, the hospital, and the soldiers, they came and they surrounded the hospital and they said they want my body. And the doctor told them that, like, you know, he's not dead yet. And he said, no, I killed him. I shot him in his head. And they didn't believe it until they went to the emergency room and they saw me, I'm still alive. And after that, they took me to Edessa and Karen in Jerusalem, and it was in 21 day in coma. You know, everybody thought I'm dead, but, you know, thank God, you know, I made it. And after like 1 month in hospital, I was there, they sent me back. They sent me back to Gaza. And I feel like for 2 months exactly in Gaza, and the same, I was in the other.
And you met Steve, and he took you to the U.S.?
And after that, you know, when I came out from jail, you know, I mean, Steve found about my case, and he, you know, and he tried to help me, and he told me, like, he was going to help me, he's going to try his best. At that time, you know, the BCRF, it was very small. It was, like mainly he was working by himself, to be honest with you. There is nobody, you know, like, there's some people helping him, but it wasn't as big as right now, you know. So, like, he was... You know, as a matter of fact, like, at that time, you know, I mean, like, it was like a one-man crew, you know what I mean? We, when I came to USA, I stayed in his house, in his apartment in Kent, Ohio, and we were a bunch of young kids and a couple of teenagers, you know what I mean? We all lived in his house, he was trying to take care of us, you know what I mean? It was a hectic for him, you know what I mean? And, you know, it's like, it's what it was like yesterday, but, you know, Steve is a great guy, man. He's a great guy. God bless him. And oh, before I forgot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He has, you know, God bless her soul, his wife, his, you know, Odell Masri. At that time, she was helping him a lot, you know what I mean? She was an angel. God bless her soul. God bless her soul. She was an angel.
How long did you stay in the U.S. to get this treatment?
Oh, for treatment, it took me like, you know, my treatment was supposed to be like about 6 months and I'm done. But what happened is like it took longer than we thought, you know what I mean? So when I came here, they sent me to Houston for treatment. And I stayed over there like about 6 months almost. But it didn't work out. So they sent me to New York Medical Center in New York. And I came back to, first I went back to Ohio, and Steve drove me all the way from Ohio to New Jersey. And when I came to New Jersey, I stayed with like the Arabic community over here, you know, the Palestinian community, they helped me out. And my treatment took like almost 3 years. Yeah.
Wow. And you're feeling better and good, alhamdulillah, now.
Alhamdulillah, I feel way better than, but I still have the aspect, you know, I mean, the pain. But you know what? Alhamdulillah. You know,
alhamdulillah.
Thank
you so much for being on True Talk. And our listeners, we're talking to Steve Sosaby. He is the founder of PCRF, Palestine Children's Relief Fund, an organization that was founded 30 years ago. And his late wife, Huda Al-Masri, was working and helping him. And I think, Steve, you created a cancer hospital or ward or unit in the occupied territories. I want to ask you about that, but also I want to know how much budget you need. You mean it's a non-profit, you need to be fundraising. How much money are we talking about annually?
Yeah, so, well, thank you for asking, and thanks, Faris, for telling your story. His story is not uncommon. It's uncommon in the sense that the soldiers would want to steal someone's dead body and try to arrest him, and it's a miracle he's alive. But unfortunately, this is a very common story for Palestinians. So our budget, we've grown quite considerably. As Faris mentioned, when we started, I was doing it by myself, and we didn't have any budget. And then over the years, we've taken on bigger projects, and sending doctors there and bringing kids out, that's not really very expensive because they're volunteers. You only cover the logistics for the most part. But when we started building cancer departments and we started building intensive care units and started taking on much larger projects on a larger scale, this obviously impacted our budget because we're paying for medical equipment, we're paying for cement and construction and so on. So our budget now is around $9 million a year. And that's because we're taking on these huge infrastructure projects. Our goal as an organization is two things. One is to deal with the urgent needs of children in the Middle East, kids who are suffering from, like Faris, gunshot injuries to the face, or from the COVID virus infections, or from the lack of food or medicine or whatever it is. On an urgent level, our organization is there to respond and provide humanitarian relief. And then on the long-term sustainable development, we're identifying deficiencies and weaknesses in the public health sector in Palestine and trying to plug those so that they are becoming more independent and more sustainable as a health system. So this is where we started the cancer department. For example, in Bethlehem, in my late wife's name, God rest her soul, it was because there were no services for children with cancer. So we decided all of these kids who had cancer in Palestine, in the West Bank and Gaza, had to leave the occupied territories for care that they otherwise couldn't get locally. And this is a huge burden for them and for their families, a costly burden. It also affects their treatment because to leave the West Bank, you need a permit from the Israeli military. To go to Jerusalem or to Israel or anywhere, you need to have permission. And that permit can be denied, can be delayed, it can affect people's treatment. So we build those services locally. That care should be provided locally, and that provides a higher level of sustainability. So that's why our budget has grown to the point where it's $9 million a year now, because we're taking on these big, large projects, which are hopefully fundamentally changing the health system in the occupied territories. And that's our goal, and that's our mission as a nonprofit organization.
Are you always able to raise the $9 million, or it's a tough road?
It's a tough road, of course, because we're a grassroots organization, so we depend on the goodwill of our communities. We have 30 chapters in the United States. You're going to speak with Lena in a moment from our Tampa chapter, who just had an event last weekend to raise money. But during the COVID, a lot of the money is through fundraising events. Like, we'll have a gala dinner. We'll have some kind of activity that we can do for fundraising. We do, for example, a cycling trip in Europe where people raise money and get pledges to cycle and to carry the Palestinian flag. We can't do those because of COVID, obviously, and that affects our fundraising significantly. But nonetheless, for 30 years now, it's our 30th year that I've been doing this, even longer than that, we have demonstrated a high level of trust and transparency in our work. We've shown our communities all over the world how efficient and how effective we are as a nonprofit on the ground. And that gives a certain level of credibility and support and sustainability for our organization. So thank God we've been able to keep up with what we're trying to accomplish on the ground, but it is constantly a struggle because the needs are overwhelming. The needs for the Palestinians in the health sector on the humanitarian scale are overwhelming, and the resources are limited. So that's the struggle that we face every day, trying to raise this money and to try to implement these projects on the ground.
I know you are starting a Ramadan campaign. Ramadan is going to be starting, inshallah, next Tuesday. And Muslims all over the world are always interested in giving charity as much as they can, and especially to Palestinians who were severely wounded by the Israeli military. Can you tell us a little bit about the campaign?
Yeah, thank you for asking, Summer. Every year we do a campaign during Ramadan because that is a period of charity for Muslims, for observant Muslims. So we like to show that we are zakat eligible, that the work we're doing for orphans and for injured and sick and needy children does fulfill the basic responsibility of Muslims to give zakat and to be charitable during the holy month of Ramadan. So we reach out and we do online different types of presentations to show the work we're doing. We try to give people the inspiration and the confidence that our organization is worthy of their support. And we're always looking to expand and reach more people all over the world who want to have an impact. I mean, again, we're not a religious organization. We help any child, Christian, Muslim, Shiite, Sunni, it doesn't matter. We're not interested in those issues. We're a humanitarian organization. But we also know that there are people want to help based on what their religious motivations are, whether they're Christian or Muslim or Jewish or whatever. People want to give because they believe whatever they believe. So we're an organization that can enable them to fulfill their religious obligation and their religious duty by supporting the work that we do. Sorry about that. So in Ramadan, it's a perfect time for us to reach out to the Muslim community and to ask them to support us and give their zakat to enable us to help more kids.
And what's wonderful, Steve, is that after, for instance, one donates via email, and it's so easy these days to donate online, you come back to the people and tell us the stories or like what's happening with these kids in Gaza and elsewhere. So this is wonderful. Let me go to Lena Kiswani. She is from Tampa. Good morning, Lena.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good, Lena. Tell us a little bit about the local chapter. How did you find out about PCRF and what kind of activities you guys here do in the Tampa area?
Yes, PCRF, I was actually a supporter of PCRF before the Tampa chapter was even established, as a daughter of Palestinian immigrants. I was born and raised in the United States, but I've always had a connection with the Palestinian people, of course, and with the children especially. And it caught my attention, I think I was my early or mid-30s. It just interested me that someone, especially an American, would be interested in helping the children of Palestine, the injured and sick children of Palestine. So I became very interested and always tried to support in any way that I could. So I was super excited when Hakim Abu Nada, a wonderful young man, helped establish the Tampa chapter PCRF back in 2016.
So what do you do, Lena? Like what Steve just mentioned, that last week there was an activity. I know it's so difficult with COVID, because I remember they used to have like a dinner and a hafla. So what was last week's event, and if there are any more events happening?
We're a fairly young chapter, and unfortunately COVID hit before we could do many face-to-face events. We did a few. We did a picnic, a couple of picnics, and we did a ladies' cultural night, which was wonderful. We got a bunch of ladies together from different parts of the world, and we read poetry in different languages, and it was a lot of fun. And since COVID hit, we've been trying to do virtual events as much as possible. And last week we did a very fun cook along with a TikTok chef, a TikTok cook. She was her name is Iman Abu Nada, and she was just amazing. And we had so much fun cooking jaddara, a very traditional Palestinian meal. And we tried to raise as much awareness. We tried to, you know, get as much support for PCRF. We'd like people to know about the wonderful work that PCRF does.
Do you do public speaking I know there isn't now, but like how do you try to raise awareness about the chapter and about the plight of Palestinian children, but also Syrian and Yemenis, because the organization is helping almost all Arabs.
Children of the Middle East, yes. Anyone that needs help, like Steve said, regardless of religion, it's a humanitarian wherever humanitarian needs are needed. And we really try to get the word out as much as we can by mostly social media right now. That's the way to do it. We try to reach as many people as we can through social media, through events, now virtual events. But before we did have a USF chapter that we are trying now to revive. A lot of the kids graduated, and since COVID, they've been doing online classes, so it's been really difficult to get the USF chapter going, and we're looking for students that are interested in helping us revive that chapter.
Can you give the website or how they can contact the local chapter, our listeners?
Yes. Well, we have a Facebook page, PCRF Tampa. Also, my phone number is out there always.
Okay.
Anytime anyone needs, I always give them my number to reach out to me directly. We have a very wonderful group of people on the board, the e-board. The best way to reach us is probably through our Facebook page. It has our contact information, our Instagram page as well, PCRF Tampa.
PCRF Tampa. Thank you so much, Lena, for being on True Talk.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Lena. I reached out to her yesterday. And if you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF, and I'm talking to Steve Sosaby. He is the founder or co-founder of one of the most amazing organizations, I think, in the Arab world and the whole universe. He treats severely wounded Palestinian kids, or at least this is how it started, who live under a constant military occupation and have to deal with the daily brutality of this occupation. And Steve is president and co-founder or founder, and soon they're starting Ramadan campaign to raise funds. Steve, one of the questions that I received, and I always, when I ever mention how I can talk to, I'm going to talk to you, is how are you able to get people out of Gaza or from Gaza to the West Bank? Like, how can you go through the hurdle of the paperwork and occupation and be able to do that?
Yeah. Well, first, let me just say thank you for having Lena on. And Lena represents the really the foundation of our organization, which is the volunteer core group of people who make our work possible. We're mainly a grassroots volunteer organization. So it's people like Lena who are able for us to function and do the work that we do. So I always want to say much respect and appreciation for our volunteers, the thousands of them all over the world, whether they're doctors or people in our communities in Tampa who take care of our kids or raise money for us to do the work that we do. So getting people out, especially out of Gaza, because the West Bank, they can travel through Jordan when the bridge is open. Of course, it's been closed mostly due to the COVID pandemic. But in normal times, what's considered normal, we do go through the process of submitting a request, and then we submit the supporting documents. So if a child, for example, needs to leave Gaza for treatment, it's not an easy process. It takes weeks. But we submit their application request to the proper Israeli authorities. We give them supporting documents. So let's say a hospital in Tampa wants to accept a child. We would get a letter from that hospital that says we're willing to treat that child. And then we as an organization, as an American organization, would write a supporting letter that says we'll take care of that child's transportation and living accommodations and everything. And then they will come back home when their treatment is finished. And with those two documents, generally, we can get a permit for these kids without too much trouble. It takes time. So we have people who are responsible for that in our organization. We have a great patient affairs coordinator in New Jersey, Dunya Saeed. And then we have a great team on the ground in Gaza, an office in Gaza, who know how to work this process and to ensure that it gets done in the best way possible.
So, Steve, if you had another $1 million, like instead of 9 this year, if you were able to raise 10 million, does that mean you can, there are more people out there that they need help?
Of course. As I mentioned before, the resources are limited and the need is great. So the needs always, especially in the Middle East and especially in this part of the Middle East, the needs always outweigh the resources. And whether it is for some of the big projects that we're doing, building up hospitals and providing expensive medical equipment, which is needed to treat patients and to develop the health system, or in the case of urgent humanitarian aid and providing medication and surgery and other forms of humanitarian support on the ground, there's always a need for more, and their inability to have to help as many people as possible is often due to limited resources. So yes, for sure.
Do you stay in touch with some of the cases, like now how we spoke with Firas? He's in New Jersey so many years later. He's almost 50 years old. You met him when he was 17. Do they keep up in touch with you? Do they in return volunteer?
Some do. Honestly, it's, Ferris is an exception a little bit because he's in New Jersey and he's also on social media. So Facebook and these type of platforms make it a little bit easier to stay in touch with some of the kids we help. We have a program in Gaza for kids who are amputees, children who've lost limbs. We've set up a Facebook group for them, and we've created a community there of all of the children in the entire Gaza Strip who are amputees. We have created a community, so I'm in touch with them that way. When I'm in Gaza or in the West Bank, I'm visiting the families often that I've established personal contact with. But we've helped thousands and thousands, so obviously it's not possible to stay up on in contact with everyone. I did over Christmas this year, went to Hebron and visited for the first time in 30 years, the first boy I brought out, who we talked about earlier on in this program, Mansour. Uh-huh. And that was quite an experience for me because so much has happened in my life over those 30 years. As Faris mentioned, I was married for 17 years to a Palestinian woman who passed away from cancer 11 years ago. You know, built this amazing organization and been able to work with so many great volunteers like Lena and so many others. And most importantly, been able to do something positive for the Palestinian people in a way which isn't controversial. It's not political. It's serving a very human cause. And that's given me great pride and great satisfaction in my life. But there's so much more to do. So meeting Mansour after 30 years kind of recalibrated why I'm doing this and the impact that it's having. Seeing this boy or seeing somebody like Faris, who now has his family graduating from high school and you know, his beautiful family and so on. That gives me so much feeling of happiness because, you know, like Faris said, he was nearly dead. He was in a coma for weeks and now he has a family, he has a life. He's raising his kids in this great country of ours, United States, where it gives people an opportunity to work hard and have a life, something that in Palestine is very hard to do, even if you do work hard. So I'm very proud of that. And it's a great accomplishment to see people like Faris living the American dream, even though life can often be challenging here as well.
And in the middle of this work, you raised two beautiful daughters as a single dad. So that was really, I'm sure it was tough juggling all this work. And then you have these two lovely daughters, mashallah. And then you remarried and married a physician. Isn't that true?
Not just a physician, but a pediatric oncologist. So she treats kids with cancer. So, and she's Sudanese American, so she speaks Arabic. And
was she volunteering in Palestine when you met her?
No, actually, I met her at a PCRF event in New York City back in 8 years ago. And she came to me, she heard about our work in building a cancer department and came and introduced herself as a fellow in pediatric oncology. And that's how we met. But the beauty of that relationship is that she worked for a while in the Huda al-Masri Cancer Department. So the cancer department we built and named after my first wife who passed away, my second wife was treating and healing children in her name and in her honor. And that really made me very proud and very happy about that.
I think this story requires a movie or a documentary or something, Steve. And if you're just joining us, we have like 3 minutes to go. And we're talking to Steve Sosabi, who is founder of PCRF, Palestine Children's Relief Fund. And he started by dealing with treating severely wounded Palestinian children who were injured by the brutal Israeli military. Then he ventured into helping Syrian refugees, Palestinians elsewhere. I know we are running out of time, Steve, but we rarely mentioned, and I'm talking maybe about myself and co-host Ahmed, about the Palestinian refugees who live in Lebanon. Were you able to reach out to them and help their kids there?
Yes, we have an office in Lebanon. We have a staff on the ground there, field workers, social workers. We are committed to the Palestinian population in the diaspora, particularly in Lebanon, because they are living under extremely harsh conditions, not able to work legally in Lebanon and not having any form of government support. And having UNRWA, their main source, the United Nations Relief and Work Agency, cut under the Trump administration and having the significant reduction in humanitarian services for those people. Our organization is on the ground in Lebanon. We have a big project going on in northern Lebanon to provide Safad Hospital in the Badawi refugee camp, $1.2 million worth of medical equipment and supplies so they can open a new intensive care and operating theater, which would serve that population in those refugee camps in the north. So we are very much committed to and active and have been for many, many years, decades. I've been going to Lebanon and working in the camps there since the organization started. So we don't differentiate. Our main focus, obviously, is on the ground in the West Bank and Gaza because that's where we started and that's where the biggest impact, and that's Palestine. But we also recognize the need to provide services for Palestinian who live outside of Palestine, whether they are in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, or anywhere else in the region. We know the needs there are great, and we are committed to helping them with full effort and full attention.
I want to thank you so much, Steve Sossaby, founder of PCRF. You can find it online if you click pcrf.net, and it's the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. Thank you so much, Steve, for being on True Talk, and Ramadan Kareem to everyone in Ramallah and the rest of the world.
Thank you for having me, Summer, and thank you. Happy Ramadan to everybody who's celebrating. Thank you all.
Inshallah. Thank you, everyone, for listening and for tuning in and for some of the messages that we received, but I don't need to read. The next week, inshallah, Tuesday, we will be starting the fasting from sunrise to sunset for Ramadan. And hopefully we're going to be talking about more and more issues. Thank you always for listening to True Talk, and thank you for supporting WMNF. You can always go to the website and donate. This is True Talk, and this is Tampa, Florida. NPR News is next.